I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity, so we saved you some time to get right to the good stuff. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Connor Cyrus. The Domestic Violence Fatality Review Commission's annual report was released by the Attorney General's office last week. In it, we learned that nearly half of all homicides in Vermont are related to domestic violence. The report includes statistics, trends, and recommendations. Today on the show, we're diving into that report. We'll go over the key takeaways and discuss how the state can do a better job of preventing these incidents from happening and responding when they do. And we'll end the show by talking about resources available to people who are experiencing domestic violence or threats of violence in their immediate relationships. And listeners, this hour we're covering sexual assault, domestic violence, and other topics that could be triggering to you. So if you're not in the space to listen today, just know that this episode will be available on Vermont Public's website when you're ready to listen. Our guests today are Attorney General Charity Clark. Attorney General Clark, welcome to the show. This is your first time since taking post as Attorney General. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
We also have Karen Thronsgaard Scott. She's the Executive Director of Vermont Network Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. Karen, welcome.
Thanks, Connor. It's great to be here.
Now, Attorney General Clark, I want to start with you. What's the role of the Attorney General's office when it comes to investigating domestic violence cases and this report?
Well, we have a criminal division which has concurrent jurisdiction with all of the county prosecutors to bring all sorts of criminal cases, including those involving domestic violence. In terms of this specific report, the Domestic Violence Fatality Review Commission was created a little over 20 years ago by the legislature, and it was housed in our office at the AG's office. It is a commission of 17 stakeholders representing all sort of areas that you would think of to have knowledge and interest in domestic violence, whether it be, you know, prosecutors or survivor, law enforcement, et cetera. And the chair of that commission is an assistant attorney general in our office, and it's sort of housed in our office. So that's our connection with the report. And, you know, as attorney general, I decided to make the report, you know, one of the first big public things that I did. So we had a press conference and just tried to amplify the message in the report and the recommendations.
Were you surprised by this report when it came out?
I wasn't surprised. The way that the report works is recommendations come from the review of the fatalities related to domestic violence for that year. So this year's reviewed the domestic violence related fatalities in 2021, and the recommendations are based on those particular fatalities. But the trends were not surprising to me, having read previous versions of this report and knowing the cases that the recommendations were based on.
And then, Karen, as the head of the network, what's your role in addressing domestic violence?
Well, the Vermont Network is a nonprofit organization that represents the voices of survivors and 15 other nonprofit organizations that provide direct services for survivors. So our role is, as a statewide entity, we advocate for policies and practices across state government, across state agencies that will support survivors and will also offer us pathways to prevent future acts of violence.
And so, Attorney General Clark, the Domestic Violence Fatality Review Commission's annual report comes out every year and includes things like stats, trends, and recommendations. And we'll get into all of that in just a little bit. But I want to know, why do we have this report?
The report was created, I believe, on an initiative by former Governor Howard Dean, my old boss, and it was created by the legislature to get recommendations based on those fatalities so that we could try to affect change and make improvements with our approach to addressing domestic violence. And over the years, many of the recommendations have been taken, and I hope very much that the legislature will move these recommendations through the legislative process as well, and that they will end up law at the end of the session.
Now, this report is based on data from 1994 to 2021. What would you say is the most important thing for our listeners to take away from this?
Well, the most important thing to me is that anyone who is listening to this who has been experiencing domestic violence knows that there are resources available to them and that people who understand what they are going through and can help them. So that's, to me, that's the most important thing. And I'm sure you mentioned at the end, we'll give the phone numbers and whatnot for folks to reach out to. But to me, the reason why I think this report is so effective is that the recommendations, because they're based on just a handful of cases, are very specific and very doable. And to me, when I looked at the recommendations, I thought, well, these are all, this isn't reinventing the wheel. These are things that we can do this session, they can get done, and we can be, you know, doing that much better, addressing domestic violence in just a few months. And then next year, maybe we'll have other recommendations that are sort of this smaller, achievable size.
Now, I think that the big, like, the headline that I think that caught a lot of people's attention in this report was that nearly half of all homicides in the state were related to domestic violence. Does that tell the entire story of what's happening in our state?
I mean, no, but I would just address first that that didn't surprise me because that is a statistic that's, as you see in the report, has been really true for decades, sadly. And the thing that to keep in mind about domestic violence is so much of it happens behind closed doors. So we have a report when someone dies, that is very public and we all hear about it. But the truth is there is so much beneath that statistic, and not just people who are even physically harmed, but people who are being threatened repeatedly, intimidated, etc. So there's just so much beneath that statistic.
Karen from the network, I want to hear your take on hearing these stats and just your reaction.
Well, I completely agree with Attorney General Clark's assertions. The most important thing for folks to understand is there's lots of help available out there in the community. And I am also sadly not surprised about the data that reveals that more than 50% of homicides are related to domestic violence in our state. I also agree that when we see even one death is a death too much, but when we see that someone's been killed under these horrific conditions, we have to know that there not only has there been a long pathway to get to that place where somebody loses their life and somebody takes their life, but there's also unseen people all over the state who are experiencing domestic violence that we aren't seeing. And the last thing I want to say is every time somebody dies as a result of domestic violence, there's a complete ripple effect. There's children, there's family members, there's community members, and we see the trauma that just reaches all corners of our state after someone's killed under these circumstances.
And can you just give us historical context for all of this? Are the number of domestic violence fatalities, are they going up? Are they going down? Like, what do we know in terms of what we've seen before?
Well, if you look at the report actually has a really beautiful graph that shows that over time, some years there are fewer domestic violence homicides. Some years there's as many as 61%. But over time, it averages to a little bit more than 50%. And I actually think we can do better. I think that this is it's an extreme marker of our success in addressing domestic violence in our communities. And I just want to say this is why it's so important that this report's being recognized by our Attorney General, because we need that kind of leadership in our state in addressing the issues around domestic violence, not just domestic violence homicides, but all the things that lead to it.
Listeners, if you're just now joining us today and this hour, we're talking about domestic violence and this report that came out by the Attorney General's office. And we want to hear from you. What are your thoughts? Have you had a chance to look into this report and ask questions? Do you have questions about how the state handles or tries to prevent domestic violence? Give us a call, 1-800-639-2211, or you can email us at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Now, Karen, how are these numbers, how do they compare to what's happening in other parts of the country and as the country overall?
Domestic violence continues to be a primary factor in both crime and health conditions across our country. Vermont is not unusual. We believe around 40% of Vermonters experience domestic violence at some point in their lifetime. That's a really high number.
It's a lot.
A really high number. In far too many of these cases, children are witnessing domestic violence. And you know, for the most part, Vermont is not unusual. Our data is very congruent with other New England states and other states in the country. But the one thing that we have to always recognize in Vermont is the is that because of the rural nature of our state, the issue around isolation can be exacerbated. And what we see for most of the situations where there's a homicide, there has been deep isolation from community and from systems that are designed to help.
And how has the pandemic changed how we address domestic violence?
Well, unusually in Vermont, the one thing that I want to say is when the pandemic hit, immediately leaders in our state started asking the question, what's going on with domestic violence survivors? What's happening in our homes? And we saw that at the very beginning of the pandemic, our hotlines went dark. No one was calling. But over the course of the first summer of the pandemic, people did start calling in. And what we saw was that they were coming out of homes with severe injuries, with much like there was evidence that domestic violence had been happening, but they couldn't leave their homes to get the help that they need.
And I want to know, when we talk about domestic violence, who are we talking about? Because I understand that there's like this false notion that it really is just like cis women who this mm-hmm. happens to, but it really goes way beyond that.
It really does. It really goes to, unfortunately, domestic violence impacts every community in our state, regardless of identity, regardless of the nature of the relationship, regardless of location, regardless of socioeconomic status. It is really a universal impactor.
Now, let's talk about the recommendations you made in the report and some other potential solutions. Attorney General Clark, what would the Attorney General's Office and Council on Domestic Violence like to see the legislature do? Earlier this hour, you said that there were some very tangible and easy things that can be done this year and that the list might change next year. So let's talk about what you're presenting.
Sure. Well, there's really two kind of buckets. There's four recommendations, and two relate to kind of an operations role for law enforcement, and the second are more of a judiciary, almost housekeeping. So I'll try not to get into the weeds because I do that. But the first one is to basically ensure that we institute the best policies when it comes to officer-involved domestic violence. And this is both for officers who might be perpetrating the domestic violence, but also those individuals who might be working at law enforcement and experiencing themselves domestic violence at home. So that would be the first one, just to make sure the policies are updated and implemented, because not every law enforcement agency in the state has a policy relating to that. The second would be to empower the Criminal Justice Council, which is the body in Vermont that that licenses law enforcement, to empower them to take disciplinary action against law enforcement officers for misconduct related to domestic violence, and also to collect better data on that. So those are the two kind of operational. I don't know if you want me to stop or go to the other items.
Let's go to the other items.
Okay. So the next relates to juveniles who are involved with domestic violence. Right now, the way that it works, an aggravated domestic assault charge goes, if it's a juvenile who is the defendant, goes to juvenile court, and that's a different system, where aggravated assault without the domestic goes to regular court. So what was happening or has been happening is prosecutors are not using the aggravated domestic, they're just using the aggravating assault so that they can go right to criminal court and not the juvenile court. Well, what's happening with that is when it is a domestic violence related case, all of the systems that are in place to support the victim and the perpetrator, who is a juvenile, are not there. And so just making sure that those are in alignment so that those benefits and systems can be taken advantage of. So that's the third one. And then the last one is to adapt to the reality of today's technology and process related to a relief from abuse order, which is, you know, like the restraining order, we would say colloquially. And I'll give you an example. What was happening before, in the before times, before the pandemic, is a person who was a defendant in a relief from abuse order case would be at the courthouse when that final order was issued by the court, and they would receive it then. Well, now if they're instead they're online participating via a video, They're not physically present to receive the order, even though they're very aware of it because they're a part of the proceeding that way. And so a sheriff has to serve that order. Well, that is slowing down the process and creating other problems. So this is just, you know, kind of acknowledging the way that we do things right now and adjusting appropriately. So those are the recommendations. I hope I didn't get too much in the weeds with you, Connor.
I think you kept it fairly simple, but okay. It also reminds me of an email that we got from somebody, and they say, unless you've had to seek a relief from abuse order in Vermont, then you probably aren't aware of how traumatic the process is. If you are the plaintiff, you show up to your hearing date, and it's your burden to prove that you've been abused. This is a public hearing, so that means, for example, in the case of rape or sexual assault, even on behalf of a minor, the plaintiff needs to recount the excruciating details, the specifics of the abuse. This is re-traumatizing, humiliating, and degrading. These hearings should be private to protect the dignity of all parties. I'd be curious to know how many Vermonters who are living with an intimate partner violence find out that by filing for a protective order, that their lives are going to be put on display for the courtroom to decide to stay in an abusive situation as the reason. So we have this process that is a public hearing that people have to relive. Is there any way to make that a private hearing so people aren't re-traumatized?
You know, it's an interesting question. I'm really interested to hear what Karen has to say about this. we have... the issue of transparency, and of course, in a criminal setting, facing your accuser is sort of fundamental to the way we do things here in this country. But it's a complicated issue. I really am truly interested in what Karen is going to say.
Hold on, I'm not going to let you skirt off that easily. I want to know, like, is this something that we can address?
Yeah, I mean, like I say, it's certainly the relief from abuse order part of a domestic violence proceeding is in civil court. It's not in criminal court. But, you know, we do have a history of making sure that someone can know who their accuser is. And we are very public with a lot of the criminal work that we do. I'm thinking of, you know, internet crimes against children work that we do, and it's all public. When it's a juvenile, we abbreviate the person's name, but
last question I'll ask, and then we can go to Karen. Is there any way to make it so it's not strangers? So it's just the, like, me. I don't know enough about the court system to know if there is a way that you can just have it privatized so it's just that party in the courtroom at that time.
You know, I don't know in that setting. I mean, there's mechanisms that you can use. I don't know if you can in that setting. I'm not sure.
Okay, Karen. Well, I want to get your response.
It's a great question. And I agree with everything Attorney General Clark has talked about in terms of our commitment to due process and transparency. These are foundational values in our court systems. And our courts, we work with the courts all the time to help them make their settings more user-friendly, more accessible to victims. But the reality is that accessing the civil or legal system is just one way for survivors to address issues. Protection orders are really important, and we want to make sure that any survivor who wants a protection order can have access to the courts to get that. And in fact, you know, in 2021, there were 3,300 requests for protection orders, and a little bit more than 2,300 of those were granted. So we know that it's a system that works, and it can be terrifically traumatizing. One thing to think about is that when somebody goes into court to get a protection order, they would benefit from legal counsel. They would benefit from having a representation from an attorney. Unfortunately, most survivors don't have money to pay for that. And so there are free legal services available. The Vermont Network hosts a legal clinic. The funding for that clinic is inadequate to meet the need. But offering survivors the opportunity to be represented when they're going for an RFA is a game changer for survivors, because they actually are there with somebody who understands how court systems work, who understands how, you know, what the words mean, you know, the legalese, what they mean, and somebody who's there in their court, who's there to support them and can help them do things like communicate with the court that they're experiencing deep trauma by having to participate and, you know, ask for an extension or ask for some support around that. So there are things that we could be doing to make our courts more accessible. They require resources. It's always the rub, but it's certainly available to us.
Now, Attorney General Clark, there are 11 domestic violence accountability programs in the state that are certified to be operating in alignment with statewide standards. What is a domestic violence accountability program? Or maybe that's a question for Karen. I'll let you pass that on to Karen.
Yeah, I'm happy to answer that question and, appreciate the relationship between the Attorney General's office and these programs. So these 11 programs operate in tandem with generally with the Department of Corrections and community members. And they operate under a set of standards that are very important. They have to meet all the standards in order to be certified, and certification is tied then to being able to be paid for services. These programs work with people who are perpetrators of domestic violence, people who have caused harm in their intimate partner to relationships, to help them change behaviors, to help them understand the harm that they've caused, to help them understand the experience, their own experience of trauma and domestic violence in childhood, and to move them into a place where they're actually able to engage in healthy and respectful ways with intimate partners.
How are kids and family members not involved? How are they impacted when it comes to domestic violence?
Well, we know from so much research that children who are living in violent homes are far more likely to be abused themselves. They're far more likely to, when they reach their teenage years, to be truant, to experiment with drugs and alcohol, to have mental health issues. And there's some correlation between people who have grown up in a violent home and then their own use of violence in their relationships when they get to be an adult. So it's a real ripple effect, and it's an intergenerational problem. And I know there are many advocates in our state who have been at this for so long that they're seeing second or sometimes even third generations of families.
Yikes. What can the state do and your organization do to prevent this?
Well, that's such a good question. I think that I'm sure Attorney General Clark has some thoughts about this, but having an attorney general who's paying attention to this report and understanding the relationship between her voice and our ability to change these laws and improve our systems is key. When a survivor calls the police, we need for them to show up and know exactly what to do to support that survivor and to help ameliorate the risk for harm. When we have family members who are seeing that someone's using violence or someone's experiencing violence, familial relationship is key, especially if you see someone who's using violence, to interrupt that and to do it with compassion and embodying their humanity. So people who cause harm are people too, and we have to recognize that. And, you know, I always think the phrase, "I'm really worried about what you're doing to this person," is a great starting point.
Any other starting points for people that are listening? Because I think that that's like a really good tip, because when our friend, our loved one is being abused, or we suspect that they're being abused, our first reaction isn't to have compassion mm-hmm. for that person. So I'm wondering if there's any other tips you have.
I do think it's really important for us to be able to talk to each other about violence in our loved ones' homes. It's a hard conversation, but it's a really vitally important conversation. It's also really important to understand that survivors know themselves and they know the person that's harming them better than anybody else. And so it would be really important to not call the police on somebody's behalf, to get permission for any action, and to help people find the resources that are available to them to get help.
Attorney General Clark, would love to get your take on how the state can better respond to and prevent these generational domestic violence cases.
Well, as you know, I took office about 3 weeks ago, and first on my agenda is creating a schedule for myself of going around the state and meeting with every domestic violence prevention organization that we have. We have nonprofits all over the state. I met with a couple of them last year when I was campaigning, and I know that in meeting with them, first of all, hearing what they have to say and seeing the facilities and all of that, but especially hearing what their input is, what we could be doing differently or better, is something that I'm looking forward to doing and have committed to doing early on in my tenure as Attorney General.
One of the ways people can protect themselves is by a restraining order. Can you just tell us what the restraining order is supposed to do and how one goes in getting one?
Well, there in Vermont, the access to we call it an RFA, a relief from abuse order, it's meant to be able to be done by someone who's not an attorney. So you can go on the court's website, vermontjudiciary.org, or I can't think of it at the top of my head, but if you Google, you'll find it. And it's meant to have the steps so that you can do it without a lawyer. It occurs in civil, in family court, which is a civil, not a criminal place. And, you know, you fill out the paperwork and you show up. And if the, you have to, there's standards you have to meet. You know, it sort of depends. It's you know, stalking or likelihood of harm, things like that. And if the standard is met and the judge issues the order, then it will be served on the defendant. And that's the, I think of it as the preliminary hearing. I think it might even be called the preliminary hearing. And then you have the final hearing. And that one, you know, one of the, and I know Karen probably has a lot to say about this, but one of the areas of tension is that on the, in the preliminary hearing, I think you have 2 weeks between the preliminary hearing and the final hearing. And oftentimes that person who filed that motion to get an RFA doesn't appear at the final hearing for a number of reasons. It's obviously very intimidating, but also keep in mind that the most dangerous time for a victim of domestic violence is when they are leaving their abuser, when they have put things like this in motion. And so they are doing what they need to stay safe. So I'm wandering from your question, which is how this proceeds, but that's basically how to get an RFA.
Do you find RFAs in Vermont to be effective in preventing domestic violence?
Well, the RFA is one of our, is a primary tool for addressing domestic violence. It is a piece of paper. And so if someone wants to violate that protection order, they generally will. But I think it's one of the things for us to understand is that in the 2021 review of domestic violence-related homicides, there were no RFAs issued. So, you know, what we can extrapolate from that fact is that they actually RFAs are helpful in preventing serious harm and homicide. And as I said earlier, what we see over and over again in cases where homicide is the result of the domestic violence is that there's deep isolation. And so people haven't been able to access the court system. They haven't been able to access the programs, the domestic violence programs. They haven't been able to access any of the things that we've put in place as a society and as a state to prevent further acts of domestic violence.
I want to go to the phones, and listeners, if you want to join the conversation, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Mary in Brattleboro. Mary, welcome to the show.
Hello.
What's your question or comment?
The question is, what happens when, if somebody has multiple restraining orders against them, or there's lots of threats of violence, no action has been taken, but, like, what happens when you've got somebody who's like off the wall, but, and people have filed restraining orders against them and there's a lot of threats, but nothing happens?
Thank you for that question, Mary. Attorney General Clark, it sounds like somebody has, in this situation, has multiple restraining orders, but hasn't done anything. Anything else can be done to ease, I guess, this anxiety of people in the community? Or in the family?
Well, if there you know, isn't probable cause for a charge in the criminal setting and you've used the tools available to you, I think reaching out to the experts who are, you know, people like the network for support and making sure that isolation that's so concerning doesn't occur. And I, of course, I'm again interested in what Karen has to say, but that would be my first response.
Karen?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that the Mary, I'm sorry that if this is happening in your life, I'm sorry that it's happening. We do see this. You know, there very often the situation is that there are limitations to what can be done under the law. And those limitations are for good reasons. They have to do with our commitment, again, to due process. And the RFA process is not the be-all and end-all. It's not the only thing we should be thinking about when we think about how do we respond to domestic violence. Right now, there's a bill in the legislature, for example, that looks at the issue of sometimes people will abuse the court systems, and so they'll use delay tactics. Their attorney will place continuances. And what happens is a very simple case of domestic violence that needs to be, you know, an issue of a final RFA gets extended out for months and months and months, and it makes it really hard for the survivor to find peace and safety and well-being when the churn continues. And so we're trying to pass a law that will interrupt that. And we also need to be thinking in our state about alternatives to the criminal justice system. Many survivors are not interested in participating in it for all kinds of good reasons. In fact, you know, in 2021, the Vermont Network member organizations, these 15 nonprofits, served just about 8,000 people, a bit short of 8,000 people in our state. Wow. But only there were fewer than 400 prosecutions of domestic violence. And so that's not any kind of indictment on a system. It's just evidence that many survivors just don't want to participate in that system. And so we have to develop alternatives.
I want to go back to the phones, and I want to talk to Jennifer in Washington County. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Do you just want me to tell my story or thoughts?
Please.
Okay. Let me know if you can't hear me. I'm on a cell phone. So I have not been a victim of domestic violence or partner violence. I've been a victim of stalking. And it's the first time that I've ever experienced this. I actually, way back in my past, have worked for domestic violence individuals. So this experience has, you know, not only been traumatizing for myself, and it's scary, but I've noticed that a lot of shortcomings in the system that I feel like I've fallen through the cracks. And there's a number of reasons for this. One, I think, you know, and I joined this show a little later on so I do agree that there's not enough funding. Some of the issues that I've come up against is that, you know, the police do not have enough force in my area to respond to calls. They have to prioritize calls. And even though I have a no contact or no stalking order, they have not been able to come out to all violations of those of that order. I'm also in a rural area, and it takes them a while, if they were to come there, to always be able to get there and witness the event.
Jennifer, so, I'm so sorry of what you're going through. In the sake of time, I do just want to take what I think is your question and your comments and have our guests respond to those. But again, I just want to say thank you for sharing your story, and I'm sorry for what you're going through. Karen, when we talk about domestic violence, how do we talk about, what is the definition of domestic violence, and where does stalking come into that definition, as we just heard from Jennifer?
Well, I'm not an attorney, and so I'm certainly not the attorney general. Suggest that Attorney General Clark could answer the legalese question about what domestic violence is. But in my mind, domestic violence is a complex thing. And in some cases, we think about domestic violence as two people who are violent with each other. But when we're talking about somebody who's experiencing stalking, we're talking about purposeful and calculated acts designed to terrorize, harm, and change the behavior of the target. Stalking goes hand in hand with domestic violence, and sometimes it's very separate from domestic violence. Regardless, stalking is incredibly serious and incredibly insidious. And there are many, many cases of people who are killed as an end result of of stalking, and also many, many cases who of people who have had to make major changes in their lives because of stalking, leave their home, leave their country sometimes. And so it is it's really important for us to know as a member of the public, but also as people who work in systems, that that stalking is really serious, and it is certainly closely related to domestic violence.
Attorney General Charity Clark, what can you tell us about the definition and how stalking plays into that?
You know, I actually like Karen's definition, in part because, you know, a criminal prosecutor is looking at, okay, what's the charge? But domestic violence is much more complicated than just the criminal charge. There's a lot that goes on that might not be a crime. It contributes to the overall problem, and et cetera. So I think that acknowledging that it's very complicated, that it's, you know, often multi-generational and all of the very complicated dynamics in play with domestic violence, is that's a better definition really than the legal definition, which teases apart what the charges might be.
Let's go to Justin in Plattsburgh. Justin, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. What's your question or comment?
So I guess it's not really a question. And again, I'm in New York, so laws and whatever are different. But I find it interesting that there's been no discussion about the role that Child Protective Services, or I don't know what it is in Vermont, Department of Family and Children or Department of Social Services, plays in all these things. I know where I am as a child protective investigator, domestic violence is a pretty good chunk of our reports. And we don't even just get the ones from law enforcement when they respond to a domestic violence call, but also from children's teachers and doctors and coaches and everybody else that are mandated reporters. And we play a pretty big role in domestic violence, at least when kids are involved or in the home. And I think that's something that isn't talked about. And we often do more to help those families in law enforcement, which is really just making an arrest or doing those kinds of things where we are there for a longer period of time and are trying to create a situation where the family is safe, whether that's what in New York we call safe and together, or safe as in helping mom or dad or whoever the non-offending parent is.
Justin, I think we got it. And we have a couple other calls that I want to get to. Karen, what is the role of the Child and Family Services?
Well, Justin, thank you so much for your service. Great question and great observation. In Vermont, we have a special unit that's embedded within our Children's Protective Services unit at DCF, at the Department of Children and Families, that specialize in serving families where there's domestic violence. Similarly, we recognize that, especially if there's children in the family, those two parents are connected to each other perhaps for the rest of, you know, their lives. And so we have to do everything we can to make sure that there's safety and understanding. Our unit in Vermont, our DCF unit, it does an incredible job. They're highly trained social workers who have special relationships with families where there's domestic violence. We also, in Vermont, have piloted and implemented cutting-edge programs that actually, they're called family group conferencing. I don't want to go too deep into the weeds, but they're actually used to make families safer and bring parents into better relationship with each other on behalf of their children.
Now, before I do want to take some more calls, but I want to make sure that we talk about what resources are available to people who are listening and want to know what where the first place to go, what the next place is, and when you think you're in a domestic violence relationship. Well, sorry, there was a lot right there. So first, let's start with identifying when is a good time to report when you think you may be in a domestic violence relationship or situation?
I think that's really up to the survivor. The survivor knows their situation better than anybody else. And so for some people, that means that they want to call the police. For some people, that means that they want to go to a domestic violence organization and get help. For some people, that means they want to go to the courts and seek an RFA. And for some people, that means that they're just going to lay low for now. And whatever that decision is the appropriate decision.
And resources for people in that situation?
Well, when I have questions about this, I call Karen, and you can too. You can call the network, and it's 1-800-228-7395 is the phone number that you can call for help.
And we, listeners, we will put that on our website, vermontpublic.org. Let's go to the calls and let's talk to Leslie in St. Albans. Leslie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to know if there's education available for family court staff, like family court judges and people like that, to try to get to root out patriarchy and sexism from that type of, because it's the family court that deals with these things. And in my case, there was a judge that I felt was very ignorant on the subject of abuse and the dynamics of it to begin with. And he was also very dismissive, I felt, towards the abuse towards me. And it was like he was separating it. It was like the abuse of the kids is what he seemed to be focused on. Was there any abuse of the kids? But as you put it earlier, the abuse towards the spouse who's the victim does affect the kids, and they witness that. And when you talk about generational abuse, I was a survivor of, you know, witnessing my mother be abused in my childhood and then entering into a case like that with myself. So it's like, it is generational, and family courts in general, everybody on the family court staff should be aware of the fact that this is a pattern, and it's, you know, it's not an isolated thing. A lot of times it is generational, and they need to be aware, like they need to understand the dynamics of it. He even labeled me timid. He labeled me timid in front of my perpetrator, my abuser. And that was not helpful at all.
Leslie.
And then he said, well, I could order him to, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I'm so sorry for everything you've been through. And thank you so much for calling the show and sharing your thoughts with us. And that's really brave. And I appreciate that. Attorney General Clark, what training is there when it comes to domestic violence in the court system?
Well, I was thinking to myself, make a note to make sure that the judiciary hears this observation and feedback, because I think it's really valuable. And, you know, we are always evolving and learning new things as a culture. And I think the awareness of being trauma-informed in your approach is incredibly important. And a lot of good points were made by Leslie there. And Leslie, I'm sorry that you went through that. It sounds really hard. But yeah, I made a note to pass that on to the judiciary, make sure that they heard that feedback.
Karen, are there any specialized programs or services for marginalized communities such as LGBTQ+ individuals or immigrants in Vermont?
Yes, there are. So at the Pride Center, Safe Space is the program that provides support and help for members of the LGBTQ+ community that are experiencing domestic or sexual violence. And then Migrant Justice also offers some support for survivors who are members of the migrant community. The Association of Africans Living in Vermont also offer programming. And it's an unmet need in many ways, but it's also marginalized communities. I mean, we could do a whole show on that, on domestic violence in marginalized communities. But it's important to know that those communities are effectively working with members of their community in ways that make sense within their cultural context.
And Attorney General Charity Clark, I want to know, how are domestic violence perpetrators held accountable? And like, what does accountability look like?
You know, it's a great question. Ultimately, we have to be focused on the survivor and what is going to work best. I think for those of us who maybe aren't as familiar firsthand what it would be like to be in a domestic violence home or in a relationship with someone who is abusing us, it seems like, well, why don't you just leave? Or why don't you just, you know, it seems so simple to us. It's actually so complicated. And we always have to defer to the survivor and what is best and what accountability looks like.
Karen, I'd like to get your thoughts on
I actually couldn't have said it better.
Okay. In this last minute, I just want to get your final thoughts, Karen.
There is really great help available out there to both people who are experiencing domestic violence and people who are perpetrating domestic violence. Attorney General Clark gave our hotline number. You can also look at our website, www.vtnetwork.org, and there's an interactive map that will show people where they can get help throughout the state.
Can you wrap it up in 15 seconds?
Yes. I want to, thank the commission for their work on this really valuable report. It's just a lot of information. It's really helpful. And I'm hopeful that the legislature passes their recommendations.
We'll have to leave it there. I want to thank my guests. We had Attorney General Clark. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We also had Karen Tronsgaard-Scott. She's the executive director of the Vermont Network Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. And thank you, Attorney General Clark.
Thanks. That's it for today's show. Today's show was directed by James Stewart. Our show is produced by Tedra Meyer and Andrea Lorien. Our managing editor and call screener today is Matthew Smith. Our theme music is composed by Myra Flynn. I'm Connor Cyrus. I appreciate you listening, and we'll talk again soon.